today's product is less riskier than the pre-GFC product. The teams of folks who actually surveyed the investor market, some of the larger financial institutions that brought the product back, really went out on a listening tour and talked to investors about the types of things they'd like to see changed. And that's where you see the first deals that started to come out in 2012, you know, had some of these protections built in that then the investors wanted to see.
Good morning. This is Deconstruct, a podcast from The Real Deal. I'm Isabella Farr.
And I'm Susanna Cavanaugh. It's Monday, February 12th. I am recovering from the flu, so I'm a little more nasally than usual. Sorry about that.
I'm glad that you're feeling better. But today we're kicking off a two-parter.
Unpacking the package security that is the CRE CLO.
So over the past few months, we've discussed the distress hitting multifamily, particularly value-add players that bought apartments in the Sun Belt using floating rate short-term debt.
Right. Those loans are in trouble. Not all of them, of course, but enough of them to take a closer look.
The sponsors, most of whom are syndicators, borrowed with bridge debt, and many of them have not finished their renovation plans. Meanwhile, rent growth has plateaued or even turned negative in some cities.
And debt service has ballooned as interest rates have risen. Rate caps, which are a protection against rising rates, those are way more expensive too.
And now loans taken out in 2021 and 2022, when so many of these players bought properties, are coming due. Some of them are now underwater. And these non-bank lenders, And the non-bank lenders that handed out these loans now have a problem on their hands in some sort of way.
Right. So these loans, many of them, aren't sitting on non-bank lenders or debt funds books. They've been wrapped up into CRE, CLOs, or commercial real estate collateralized loan obligations. Those are securities that are then sold to investors, bondholders that own some of the debt.
Notably, the CRE CLO is sort of a 2.0 to the infamous collateralized debt obligation, which was at the heart of the great financial crisis in 2008.
Right, the CDO. So when CRE CLO issuance began to pop around 2018 or so, there were a number of ominous headlines. Here's ours from March 2018. The CLO, a financial crisis boogeyman, is making a comeback.
But this version of loans packaged into bonds was supposed to be a safer bet, a less risky product. The problem now is that the collateral for these loans isn't doing so hot, and there is a lot of that debt, mostly because the multifamily market went so crazy from 2021 and into 2022.
When rates were low. And one lender that's sort of showing its cards so far as those bad loans is Arbor Realty Trust. Short seller, Viceroy Research, which we have to say stands to profit if Arbor doesn't do well, if its stock falls. Viceroy has looked at Arbor's books and put out a number of reports showing sweeping delinquencies.
Arbor's earnings are coming up on Wednesday, and next Monday we'll have an episode for you on how it fared and what those figures might tell us about the CRE CLO issuers that aren't publicly traded and therefore not obligated to disclose their financials.
But we're starting this week with a rundown of what these CLOs are, how they relate to the product that drove the GFC, and what tools issuers have to deal with growing distress.
So I spoke to Stuart McLean. He's an attorney at DeChert based in Charlotte and one of the few true CRE CLO experts out there. We'll get into how the product was born, how it's designed to protect investors, and how CLO issuances have boomed over the last couple of years. But first, the news. Let's start with Niemeyer. Forgive us on the pronunciation. Our reporters, Catherine Kalergis and Keith Larson, who have been following that story, still aren't sure if that's quite right.
Yeah, Catherine told me one thing and Keith told me another. So, but I think that we'll have some clarity soon from the courts. So some background here. Niemeyer is the former principal of HFC Capital, which is a New York City development firm that collapsed amid a flurry of lawsuits and foreclosures, just a mess of bad dealings.
This story is incredibly weedy and it does span years, but I think it's fair to say the biggest news around Meyer right now stems from the 11th luxury condo project HVZ developed in Chelsea.
Yeah, you can't miss this project. It's two twisting towers, and they've been renamed One High Line. It's funny. I remember I talked to an architect a few months ago, and I was asking him which projects in the city he disliked the most, and he said One High Line.
Why was that?
Because they twist, and he was saying from a design perspective, like, you put bathrooms on top of bathrooms when you build, so that project is just complicating things for the sake of complicating things. So anyway, HFC pays a crazy amount for this full block site to build these properties in 2015, $870 million. HFC gets a $1 billion acquisition loan from JP Morgan, BlackRock, and SL Green, and then a $1.25 billion construction loan from a UK hedge fund. And the latter was one of the biggest construction loans ever issued in the city at the time. HFC hires OmniBuild as a contractor. In 2016, they begin construction.
So now Meyer faces criminal charges from the Manhattan District Attorney. The New York Times broke the story. Manhattan DA Alvin Bragg indicted Meyer, a couple of HFC employees, and a few OmniBuild executives on grand larceny charges. The allegations are that the executives, number one, falsified construction costs, number two, conspired to steal about $86 million from HFC investors, subcontractors, and the city.
Meyer was arrested last Monday in Miami-Dade County, which we broke that news. He also faces tax fraud charges in New York.
And a busy week. The Friday before that, Meyer had filed for bankruptcy. He claimed he had no income, $30 million in liabilities, and $50 to his name.
And to be fair, this isn't the first time he's cried poor. He has been tied to another lawsuit with an Israeli car importer who lent Meyer and HFC's founder, Ziel Feldman, millions on an Upper East Side condo project. HFC defaulted on the loan, which he and Feldman had personally guaranteed. So Harlap's company won a nearly $19 million judgment against Meyer in 2021 and Feldman in 2022, but Meyer refused to cough up anything.
And that's despite chartering private jets, splurging on yachts, having $1.5 million in gold.
He claimed his wife was bankrolling all of that. He didn't have any money. He was held in contempt of court after he moved. But then he was held in contempt of court after he moved $1 million out of restrained accounts, still not paying Harlap. And then he filed for bankruptcy to keep himself out of jail.
And then we have the Manhattan DA's charges.
Right. So he's expected to be extradited to New York. On Friday, Keith Larson published a look at how Meyer's schemes worked, and Catherine Kalergis had the inside scoop on his Florida arrest. So definitely check out both of those stories.
Yeah, definitely a whirlwind. Let's touch on a few more news highlights. You reported on a couple more instances of rent-stabilized distress in New York, and that's coming on the heels of NYCB's problems, which we covered last week.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the first one is sort of a best guess, but it's interesting. Icon Realty Management, which is a Soho-based firm, it acquired a good number of rent-regulated buildings before the rent law changed. It failed to pay off $142 million single borrower securitized debt, meaning that it had all of the loans in this pool when it matured on New Year's Day. That debt is now in special servicing, and so is $30 million in loans that is in a separate pool. Important here is that the buildings are not 100% rent stabilized, meaning that the firm would have been able to raise rents in some of the units in these properties. About a quarter of the portfolio is rent regulated, but I have heard from some sources that have faced foreclosure on rent regulated properties that that percentage is enough to drive distress. And the foreclosures that we've seen so far have been for 100% rent stabilized properties, but that's sort of just the tip of the iceberg, and we're going to see it affect more as time goes on. The portfolio is also borrowed at a relatively low cap rate, a little under 4%, and a cap rate expansion over the last few years that's knocked a good bit off valuations. And then we also saw a rent-stabilized owner take a huge haircut at two Riverside Drive properties. They're about half rent stabilized, and BGO, or Bentall Green Oak, sold them to Aya Acquisitions for $31 million. That's a 64% discount to what BGO had paid for the properties in 2013.
It seems like that distress is really coming to a head.
Yeah, I think so. And it's going to be a big struggle when more of these owners have to refinance. You know, Signature is gone. New York Community Bank has basically not lent to multifamily recently, it said in its last earnings call. it said it's because there's not many deals, but I've heard from sources that it's not willing to do workouts on loans that are in trouble or offer refinancings.
Yeah, we're seeing the same sort of thing in LA, where a lot of regional banks have pulled back from multifamily lending just because they think that they have enough on their books. One thing I have heard from sources is that life insurance companies are still out there making loans. So I know that borrowers are turning to them, which is interesting. But there are no solvency issues at NYCB though, right?
I mean, not that we can see yet. It actually explicitly told investors on Wednesday that it had enough cash to stay afloat. Its stock popped a little bit on the news and it's held steady since, but it's also down over 50% from the afternoon before it reported earnings. So it really hasn't seen any sort of major snapback since that initial fall.
Yeah, we'll keep watching for that.
And then do you want to talk about Tides? You broke that story. I know this is a long news roundup, but this was a newsy week.
Yeah, it really was. So Tides Equities, one of the more prominent aggressive multifamily syndicators, is now looking for more cash to shore up 30 properties across the Sunbelt. It's looking for about $69 million in preferred equity, and it's looking for that cash alongside one of its largest equity partners, AMC Investments, which has already put in $300 million in equity into Tides properties.
And that's happening after many of its loans, which are the mortgages packaged into CRE CLOs that we're about to discuss. It's after those loans landed in sort of rough waters. Tide got modifications, it told us, but it still needs more cash, a good bit of it.
Yeah, it said it needed the preferred equity to address debt service shortfalls, pay to replace rate caps, which are, you know, the hedges we talked about earlier, and pay goods and services expenses that have not been paid yet. So it definitely needs the extra cash. So this is a bit of a weedy episode. The CRE CLO is a financing vehicle and a pretty complex one at that. So first, here's Stuart McQueen at Deckard on what a CRE CLO actually is.
It's effectively a leverage tool for primarily non-bank lenders. That's who pretty much operates in the space, bridge lenders in particular.
Some of the largest CRE CLO issuers are Arbor Realty Trust, Loancore Capital, Rialto Capital Management, and Ares Real Estate Income Trust. Those are the sorts of non-bank lenders that Stuart is talking about.
And it's utilized to effectively finance a portfolio of mortgage loans that are secured by commercial or multifamily properties. More specifically, it's a securitization vehicle that acquires a portfolio of mortgage loans and issues floating rate debt securities in order to finance the acquisition of those loans.
So the CLO is a pool of these floating rate loans, and they sell off securities in these loan pools to finance them. Now, this is different from the traditional commercial mortgage-backed securities or CMBS deal.
CMBS is more of a sale technology, where the folks who originate the loans that go into CMBS deals are looking to get the exposures off their balance sheets. So they use the CMBS vehicle to do that. CRE CLOs are, on the other hand, are primarily used by bridge lenders who are looking to, for lack of a better phrase, finance their balance sheet, finance their assets. So they're not looking to get off balance sheet treatment. They're really looking to find a financing tool to help finance their business. CMBS, typically, at least in the conduit space, and includes fixed rate mortgage loans, stabilized properties, non-transitional assets. Whereas in CRE CLOs, you're typically dealing with floating rate, short-term mortgage loans that are secured by transitional properties.
In short, CRE CLOs are really designed for properties that need work. They need to be leased up. They might have some income issues. The owners might be planning to renovate the properties. But CMBS deals are really designed for leased up, well-performing assets. We've touched on CMBS in the past, but I'll give you an example. Unibail Rodamco Westfield closed a $925 million CMBS deal last year to refinance a huge mall in Century City on the west side of LA. The property was 94% leased when the deal closed and did $200 million in sales from March 2022 to March 2023. Needless to say, it's doing well. Because CRE CLOs are really designed for these, quote, transitional properties, the product lends itself really well to multifamily properties that need renovations. That's why so many syndicators turn to these sorts of loans. And we saw this boom in 2021. According to TREP, nearly $24 billion out of the $30 billion in CRE CLO originations in 2021 were for multifamily.
It was obviously a very attractive asset class. Obviously, we talk all the time about housing in this country and the need for more housing. So there's a lot of projects that were coming up. Particularly with the CRE CLO, the boom, in my view, was driven primarily because of where the pricing was shaking out in the CRE CLO market. During that time period, we saw AAA securities going for under sub 100 basis points. So it was really attractive to lenders, who bridge lenders in the space, to utilize the CRE CLO technology.
Now, to really understand the CRE CLO, we need to talk about its predecessor, the collateralized debt obligation, or CDO.
So the CDO, the CRE CDO, was around the pre-global financial crisis, the pre-GFC, and it was a product that developed in order to also primarily finance bridge assets. But some of the key differences between the modern-day CLO and the pre-GFC CDO, other than one letter, is the CDOs primarily finance subordinate assets like B notes, mezzanine loans, REIT debt securities. Some had synthetic real estate assets in them. It was really a hodgepodge of different types of exposures within the capital stack for a commercial or a real estate based loan.
So much riskier. The CLO was essentially reintroduced to the market to remove some of the risk that came with the CDO.
In contrast, the modern-day CLO is primarily secured by first lien mortgage collateral. Makes it less riskier and more attractive to investors. The modern-day CLO has higher subordination levels than compared to the pre-GFC CRE CDOs. One other thing that's a key difference in my mind is the reinvestment periods today in the CRE CLO are a lot tighter or narrower, so like 2 to 3 years versus in the pre-GFC. The CDO had 5 and sometimes greater 6 years and beyond reinvestment cycles or periods in those deals. So today's product is less riskier than the pre-GFC product. The teams of folks who actually surveyed the investor market, some of the larger financial institutions that brought the product back, really went out on a listening tour and talked to investors about the types of things they'd like to see changed. And that's where you see the first deals that started to come out in 2012, had some of these protections built in that the investors wanted to see.
Coming out of the financial crisis, not everyone was on board right away. But then in 2011 and 2012, you just saw more lending and more acquisitions.
I think it took some time for investors to get to know the product, get past the GFC hangover from this old CDO product, and really buy into the space.
Now, when the CLO product was reintroduced, there was one major change. The structure was altered so investors and the original lender had aligned interests. In almost all CRE CLOs, the original lender will hold a huge chunk of securities in the CLO pool. And most often, they're the most junior stakeholder.
So there you have the first layer of the alignment of interest. They're the first loss piece in the deal, significant portion of the bottom of the capital stack, to where their interests are aligned with the more senior investors, the investment-grade investors. The other alignment of interest comes in the fact that since these are transitional assets, these loans are split usually into a portion that is funded on the CLO and a portion that's funded off the CLO on the sponsor's balance sheet. So there you have a true pari passu alignment of interest between the CLO debt and the portion of the debt that's held on the balance sheet. It's kind of an L type alignment of interest.
So if a borrower stops paying off the debt, the CLO pool will first stop paying out any proceeds to the most junior bondholders. And in most cases, that's the lender. So it's not really in the lender's interest to let the pooled loans go delinquent. We actually saw this happen last year. GVA Real Estate Group, which is a multifamily syndicator out of Austin, became delinquent on about $56 million in loans. Those loans were originated by Ready Capital and put into a CRE CLO pool. Now, because of the delinquencies, there wasn't enough interest to pay off all the bondholders. Payments to the more junior investors stopped, and they were rerouted to the more senior note holders. Basically, the borrowers were not paying enough to pay off all CRE CLO investors. That's the reason this protection is in place. There's an incentive to keep the loans current.
The underlying borrowers under these loans, since these are transitional assets, have business plans to bring the asset to stabilization. They are high-touch assets. They're assets where the borrowers and the managers and the CLO are in constant communication, constant dialogue in order to make sure that the loan remains performing and you know how they can work together to achieve a common result.
Now, there are remedies to help prevent delinquencies in the pool. First, they can replace loans within a CRE CLO.
There are two scenarios, at least two scenarios, but primarily two scenarios where a sponsor can buy the asset out of the pool. And that is if the asset is credit impaired, which is the way to think about that is reasonable likelihood or imminent risk of default in the near term. The other is if the asset becomes a defaulted asset. If it's delinquent, say delinquent on the payment of principal and interest for more than 60 days, it will be classified as a defaulted mortgage asset. In those two scenarios, the sponsor has a right to repurchase the financial asset, the mortgage asset, for par, basically taking out, fully protects investors. A lot of sponsors are doing that, right? You know, they're choosing to pull these assets out in order to protect investors. For obvious reasons, it's easier for them to restructure and work loans out on their balance sheet than it necessarily is in the CRE CLO, because of there are consequences to certain types of modifications that are done on these assets in the CLO within the CLO technology. There's all kinds of structure built within this technology to address non-performing assets and what we have to do. A number of investor protections built into the deal. But, you know, I noted that the loans are high touch. They're constant dialogue with the borrower. So some loans may not be in distress today, but you're looking out a year or 2 years from now and how do we reposition the asset to make it continue to be performing over the life cycle of the deal. It has a significant impact, especially today's interest rate environment or the last 18 months worth of interest rate environments has really caused, I wouldn't say a lot of problems. It is just these deals have been more actively managed over the last 18 months due to the higher interest rates and working with the borrowers as they approach, you know, maturity on some of these loans. You know, we'll see a lot more of that this year, we're in 2024, but, you know, we'll see a lot more of that, but there are, you know, a number of options available to CRE CLO issuers and or sponsors and a number of ways to work these assets out within or restructure these assets within the CLO technology.
And for the most part, Stuart said all of these protections, the ones put in place to redesign the CDO, are working.
I said we're finding out right now that as we are working through some of these issues that sponsors are facing, that the technology as designed is working. Investors are being protected. We're not seeing any losses to investors. You're seeing sponsors behave in ways that are in the best interest of the investors, you know, in the context, you know, in line with what the limitations and duties are under the CLO documentation.
Deconstruct airs every Monday on Apple, Spotify, and wherever else you get your podcasts. Or you can listen at therealdeal.com. For comments on this episode or on the series, feel free to reach me or Susanna at podcasts@therealdeal.com. Next week, we're looking at Arbor Realty Trust and their exposure to some of the CRE CLO issues we've spoken about today. Tune in then.